Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by host of the No Such Thing as a Fish podcast, QI Elf, creator of BBC's Museum of Curiosity, co-author of the Book of the Year 2019, Dan Schreiber.
Hey, Chris.
Hello.
We're both, this is weird, eh?
I know. We're both in our self-isolation inspiration stations.
Yeah.
As Bob Mortimer calls them.
Yeah, you've got a beer on the go. I'm really jealous.
Yeah. We've both got beards on the go as well.
We've a massive beard. Yeah. My razor is currently doing its own isolation in London. I'm at my in-laws. So I'm stuck without it for the time being.
It's looking good. So, first of all, obviously we're talking about a Paul McCartney album, but first of all, before we do that, tell me how you first discovered the Beatles.
I was trying to work this out. It was, I think it was 1995, so I would have been 10 or 11 at the time. I was living in Hong Kong, I was born and raised in Hong Kong, and I was at home, and my dad said, hey, I've got a movie I want you to watch, and it was the Imagine documentary.
Yeah,
on Laserdisc.
Ooh.
So we sat down, we put it on, and I distinctly remember the universe shifting. I just couldn't believe, because it wasn't just the music, it was the visuals, it was the four boys doing their thing and starting out, and the humor that they had and the cheekiness, and then it went on to Lennon's life, and just watching, I got to watch the whole Beatles story on my first pass of, you know, it's not like I was introduced to a song, I just got the whole story. And then we went into the Lennon territory, and I remember there was a moment where we got up to Double Fantasy in it, and they played in the background they played Beautiful Boy, and it was a montage of him with Sean, all this home video footage, and there was the lyric, which is, I can hardly wait to see you come of age. I think I might be misremembering it, or it was he was doing a voiceover from a chat talking about, I'm so excited about the years to come, like on Dick Cavett or something.
Yeah.
And I remember my dad going, ah, so sad you didn't get to see that, John. And I didn't know he died at this point.
No.
So I was like, hang on, what the hell's going to happen? And then it got to that moment, and I was devastated.
Wow.
And I can remember being absolutely devastated. I experienced John Lennon's death in real time, but I got his whole life in one 2-hour piece. I didn't expect for that to be the ending. So it was a really awesome introduction, and I still get furious about his death. I feel really sad. You wake up and remember things. I'll remember he's dead and be like, fuck, he's dead. And, you know, he died 4 years before I was born. So it's a weird thing to get. So that was the kind of initial thing. And I went to Hong Kong Records and I bought Imagine on CD. And I took it everywhere with me in my Discman. I remember sitting in weird... It's odd. It's just such a memory of this one soundtrack that I used to take everywhere with me.
Yeah.
And then I think it was in 1997, Anthology 1 came out. And there was all this talk about the premiere, and it was going to premiere a new Beatles song. And which was obviously Free as a Bird. And I stayed up late at night, way past my bedtime, to see this. And there was a countdown, and they played the song, and it blew my mind away. It's my favorite Beatles song.
Really?
Just because of the emotional attachment. I got to watch a new Beatles song lobbed into the world. And I went to Hong Kong Records the next morning, and I waited outside. I started the queue, a queue that did not form behind me.
Oh.
It was a one-man queue to buy Anthology. And I was the first person, I think, in Hong Kong to buy it on a sort of official release day.
Brilliant.
So it was, and none of my friends were into the Beatles. It was seen as a much older thing. So I kind of, they were my band in Hong Kong, which was kind of cool. It was like, hey, have you heard of this band?
Yeah.
The Beatles. And no one knew them. So yeah, it was about 11 years old is when I got into it.
And the album that you've picked today is Paul McCartney's September 2005 album, Chaos and Creation in the Backyard. So why did you choose this one?
This album came out when I had just moved to the UK. I got here in 2003, late 2003, and it was the first time I'd ever moved out of home. It was the first time I was fully on my own with a group of old Hong Kong friends, actually, who I hadn't seen since Hong Kong. And we sort of reunited. Mm. And there was a real sense of, okay, this is my new life. And interestingly, Beatles have always been part of my life, but I'd never explored the solo works as much. It was always Beatles. Mm. John Lennon maybe a bit more so, just through the compilations of like Classic Legend and stuff like, sorry, Classic, no, Lennon Legend, that was it.
Oh, yeah.
I had all that sort of stuff, but I didn't really know the others as well as I should have. And bizarrely, my grandmother was living in Kosovo at the time with the UN, and I moved out there for 3 months. And while I was out there, there was a bootleg CD store, and they used to sell all the individual albums. But they also had these CDs that had all the MP3s on it as a zip file kind of thing.
Oh, right.
So I'd buy one CD, and I had every single George Harrison album, and I had every Ringo album, and Ringo-rama had just come out.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, or it'd come out like a year or two before, and so I was walking through Kosovo listening to Ringo-rama.
You're the first person.
Have you explored that?
I have, yes. I do like it. You're the first person I've ever spoken to who's actually acknowledged that album exists.
It's a bizarre album. It's got one of my favorite lyrics of all, which is, I think it's near the end of the album. It's called Elizabeth Rains, the song.
Yeah.
And it starts with a marching band, and it's meant to be a song about the Queen. And the opening lyric is, "The Queen Mum is dead, but she lives in my head." And it's such an odd... If it was like, Ringo's written a song about you, Mom, you know, I wouldn't want to suddenly hear about the death of my mother as the opening. I think there's like a chorus before it, so that sweetens it nicely as well, because it comes out of nowhere.
Softens the blow.
I was walking through Kosovo, listening to Ringo-rama.
Cool.
And then got into All Things Must Pass, which blew my mind, and all the solo work stuff really, really blew me away. But there was something about Chaos and Creation in the Backyard coming out, which suddenly felt like it was mine, and in this new life that I had, living as someone who had to pay rent all of a sudden and was in a different country. I'd moved over from Australia, where I did high school, and it had so many interesting things that sort of made me think, this is going to be different. And the main one being Nigel Godrich. So Radiohead being one of my favorite bands as well. Suddenly the mixture of that, the thought was, what the hell is this going to be? And there was a really cool bit of artwork, I don't know if you remember, that came out with it, which had his name done, that you could flip it upside down. Ambigram. Oh, my God. Turns out they're really easy to do. I found a site the other day where I can do my name. There it is. You've got it in your hand. Yeah. I mean, how cool is that? I'd never seen that before. So to me, that was like wizardry. I just thought, you know, when you... All those things where people look for connections of the Beatles and try and suggest that there's something bigger going on. Yeah. I was like, holy shit, it's been written in the universe. Paul McCartney's name works upside down backwards. This is insane. So, and then it's an album that I've just consistently gone back to. I also happen to think it's one of the best albums released by any of them. The songs are fantastic. They strike all these incredible chords. So it's one of those things where usually on a Paul album or any of their albums, there will be a song that just, to me, outright disappoints me. I just get to the end and I go, damn it, I wish there was just, you know, a little moment. And in Chaos, there are a few songs where I'm thinking, no, I'm not going to be into this. And then he hits a chord that just hits me and I think, okay, that's it. I can listen to this song over and over now because I know that's coming. Yeah. And he does that every single time on that album. I'm happy now that I've looked around online that I didn't realize it was rated as highly as I hoped it would have been in his canon of work. Mm. It's up there in the sort of top five on most lists that I've seen of best McCartney albums. But mainly the reason I've picked it is because there were plenty of other albums I wanted to do, but I love your podcast so much that I don't want to hear me talking about them. I want to hear your other guests talking about them. So this is me picking this because, A, I do love it. I thought it might not be on the top list of a lot of people, but also I wanted to find out more about it because I don't know much about the making of it. And this was a good excuse to look into it.
Well, we've got plenty of time.
Yeah.
I mean, this could almost be McCartney 3. In that he's pretty well playing all the instruments himself. This is purely due to Nigel Godrich, who, when they first started this in 2003, Paul was working with a producer called David Kahn, who'd previously done Driving Rain. And they recorded about half a dozen songs, and then Paul scrapped the sessions, didn't he? It wasn't working. And George Martin was the one who recommended Nigel Godrich. And as you say, he'd worked with Radiohead, REM, U2, Beck. But for me, the resonating band that he worked with the Divine Comedy, on an album called Regeneration, which was a very bleak, dark album that surprised a lot of fans. You know, the band were known as sort of jaunty and semi-classical pop, but it suddenly took this dark turning.
Like the dead on a bed of roses. Me and my lovely wife, we're in the prime of life. I wanna feel real, wanna freewheel, wanna steal the show from under their noses. I wanna get you off. Well, ain't that enough? I'm gonna have you sail down my ivory tower by myself.
And the same thing with that. Godrich's influence can be heard throughout. But the first thing he did was said, right, the touring band that Paul was recording with during the first eight songs, after about a week, Nigel said, get rid of them. Just do it on your own. You want to get your hands dirty. So it's really taking him back to basics. And I think it's the fact that Paul let him do that. There were a few arguments. There was a lot of tension. Because I don't think anybody really, other than Lennon, maybe Elvis Costello, had ever told Paul, well, no, you're not going to do that, or had the bottle to do that to Paul McCartney. So fair play to Nigel Godrich for kind of standing up to him. And I think the phrase he used, take him out of his safety zone, but I think what he did was push him more into that creative 67 creative zone for me.
That's I totally agree with you, and that was part of the excitement of going into the album, was knowing that story that Nigel had created a lot of tension in the studio, because we do know that the Beatles, particularly the writing relationship of John and Paul, was driven by competition, was driven by jealousy and wanting to be the best writer. And that's where you get the best out of Paul. He's effectively, he's what's the Hulk when he's not the Hulk?
Oh, Banner, David Banner.
Yeah, Banner. Yeah, he's Banner, right? That's Paul through life. He's Banner. And you want him to hulk up and come out with these fucking awesome songs. Yeah. And that's what Godrich was doing. He was being Robert Downey Jr. He's being Iron Man, going, come on, man, let him out. Let the beast out. And that's what he did. And that's where you get Paul at his best. So that was really exciting. And you do read accounts where people were fired because they've pushed him too far. There was an episode of your show with David Quantick where he was talking about he would jab people in the chest and say, I wrote yesterday, or who wrote yesterday, you know. Sort of, and, you know, I bet Godrich had to just go, okay, one day I'm going to be fired, but I'm going to be fired doing the right thing, which is trying to get the best out of him. Because he must be surrounded by yes men who just love everything he's done right. I actually met and kind of worked with Paul back in 2008, I think it was. It was after Memory Almost Full. Is that the follow-up album? It was almost. Yeah. It was just after that was released.
Wow!
And it was a very bizarre project. It was I was working with an animator called Jeff Dunbar, and we were making small clips of classic jokes that he was animating in this beautiful Disney-esque style. And he suddenly said one day, my buddy would like to produce the music that's being done on this. And that person happened to be Paul McCartney.
Wow.
And I was like, what? Okay, I don't think we can afford him. And he said, no, don't worry. He just likes it. He likes the project. He wants to do it.
Wow.
So we went to his windmill. He's got a windmill studio.
Oh, yeah.
And I sat next to him during this whole process. And he had his son, James, had written the songs for it. So James was in the studio doing this stuff. And Paul gets in and he starts going on the bongos as part of this thing. Now, I remember I'm sitting in the studio and I'm hearing this bongo playing to this little bit of guitar riff, thinking at the time, this is fucking incredible.
Yeah.
This is as good as the Beatles. And I imagine that if you're in a studio with Paul McCartney, no matter what shit he's playing, it's going to sound like God is playing. And no wonder. And then the album comes out and he's probably going, why did no one tell me? Why did no one say that sucked?
Yeah.
Why? Because it's, you can't help. You're in a spell. I honestly, the bongos I heard that day were just divine.
They resonated. Yeah.
Yeah.
Completely. It's, you know, it's Paul, as you say, yeah, he's been so used to being told yes all the time that the fact that I think he said about Nigel Godrich as well, there were one or two moments on the album where I had to think to myself, you know, I could just fire this guy, but hats off to him, he didn't. He stuck with it. And I think with the Beatles as well, it was always the underlying thing was that the song was the most important thing. Forget the arguments or whatever. And it seems Paul was doing this with this album, with his songs as well. He just wanted to get the best out of the songs.
Yeah, and I know, so Ian Lee did your show and he picked Memory Almost Full.
Yeah.
And what's interesting for me is I remember that coming out afterwards and thinking what a step backwards it was for Paul. I just thought there's no synergy to this album. It just feels like a collection of songs that are, you've just popped them out. Except for, I mean, I do like it as an album, but I just thought, no, it feels like we've gone backwards here. It feels like you were really taking off with something new here. There's one song on it, which I actually thought was on Chaos and Creation. So whenever I listen to Chaos and Creation on a playlist, I pop it on to the end.
Oh, good.
Because in my head, it belongs to that album, which is The End of the End, which I just think is stunning. The, you know, on the day that I die, I want jokes to be told and songs that were sung to be laid out like carpets. Those aren't the proper lyrics, but in that vein, I absolutely love it. Mm. But there's one other reason why I picked this album is I do love when the latter day careers of some of these greats are happening in front of us. The record sales go massively down for them in comparison to the heyday. The general, if you say to anyone in the street, hey, have you heard McCartney's Egypt Station album, will say no. I think I heard the single on radio, possibly. Yeah. No one's listening to this stuff, and it feels like you've discovered the band again.
Yeah.
You know? They're ours. Paul's mine. He's not going to be at a concert because he's still playing the O2, but I will be the only one going nuts when he suddenly plays a song from Chaos, or he played, the last time I saw him live, he played Temporary Secretary.
Oh.
Everyone around us was in Paul shirts, didn't give a shit. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? And that's such a cool thing that it suddenly feels like it's yours again. Like, Paul is no longer the masses. He's to you and me, we're talking about Chaos. No one's heard Chaos. It's really weird.
I think also Nigel Godrich, going back to the Divine Comedy album, Joby Talbot, his presence on the album, on the string arrangements, that brings a whole new sound to it as well. But I think obviously the biggest presence that's looming over the whole album is Heather Mills, who a lot of the songs, if not all, are about. I think, again, on Memory Almost Full with Ian Lee, we were talking about, obviously, that album was started before this album and then finished after it. So that's why it sort of goes back and forth. So you've got the earlier songs where he's singing about his love, and the end, obviously, the relationship had broken up by then. But this album's very weird in that you've got a bit of both. There's some definite tensions with the relationship. But again, as we said, who knows what went on in their marriage? It clearly didn't work. They didn't get on. But she did take a lot of flack for whatever reasons. You know, you think about Twitter trolling now. She was going through that pretty well on her own, I imagine, with seemingly the whole world and the media against her. So, yeah, I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
I always have a sympathy for anyone who's in the surrounding area of a Beatle and the way that they get smacked by the media. Are we talking specifically about trolls? Or are we talking about her influence on the album?
Well, a bit of both, really. I think because lyrically...
No, you go.
No, I just think lyrically, there's a lot of love for her and there's a lot of yearning for her on the album. He would have been seeing the press as well. So part of it, he's kind of sticking up for her. And then part of it, you think, that ain't going so well.
Yeah, I find it really hard to work out where he's going with his lyrics, because often in interviews he talks about meaning being found in them after the fact. He's sort of, there's a couple of songs on this album where Heather will say to him, "Oh, like that, like the incident that happened to me when I lost my leg, when I was hit by a car." And he'll be like, "Oh yeah, that's what that's about." And he'd never meant to write it. And I do wonder how conscious he is of meaning in his songs, or whether he likes for them to be interpreted at a later date. I can never put my finger on that, because some lyrics, you know, one day someone's going to work out the incredible philosophical deepness of "Let Him In," and and we're going to look at those lyrics on the page differently to how they are, but they mean something to him, because when he published his book, Blackbird, the poetry book, he included "Let Him In" as the lyrics, as a bit of poetry. And it's, as you know, the song, someone's knocking on the door, someone's, do me a favor, open the door, let him in. It's a very boring piece of paper to read. And I think he's thinking, nah, pop it in there, someone's going to find it, someone's going to know. So I don't know. I don't know if the lyrics in this album, it's hard to pinpoint. He talks a lot of love for her, and then you're going, the ones where there's tension, is he talking about her, or is he talking about Lennon? Is he talking about just someone? He must have so many friends we don't know of in his life that just, it could be them. It's, I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea. You mentioned Joby Talbot. This is another interest for me, because I think the first time they ever met was when Joby was doing the orchestration for the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie. I know that while they were recording that, Paul popped in and looked over it and saw what was going on. That might not have been the first time that they met, but Beatles' connection with people who work on comedy things for me is always such an interesting thing. I love whenever I hear that they in some way, I mean, the classic being George Martin was Spike Milligan in The Goon and Peter Sellers producer, and that really turned the Beatles on when they met him, because they loved The Goon so much. And the opening Atmos and Cheers in Sergeant Pepper's is beyond the fringe. I mean, we're hearing the applause for Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and Jonathan Miller and Alan Bennett. That's so cool that's sitting on there. Yeah. And I was talking to John Lloyd, the producer who I work with, the other day about Frog Chorus song, and didn't know this. Paul hired to punch up the jokes for the video of the Frog Chorus for £1,000 a day. He hired Douglas Adams, him, John Lloyd, and Terry Jones to write the jokes for that.
Really?
Yeah, so I just love, all these little comedy connections with the Beatles. And Joby Talbot is one for me, the Hitchhiker's Guide connection.
One, two. There is a fine line between recklessness and courage. It's about time you understood which road to take. It's a fine line, and your decision makes a difference. Get it wrong, you'll be making a big mistake. Come home, brother, all is forgiven. We all cried when you were driven away. Come home, brother, everything is better. Everything is better when you come home and stay.
So should we move on to the album?
Let's do it.
So we start with track one, Fine Line.
So what I really love about this song is it starts, for me, quite bland. You've got something that's a bit, it's in the area of Paul that I'm not overly interested in, their deep love of old rock and roll, that sort of, when he does acoustic versions of his song and he goes into a 12-bar blue version of it halfway through the song, I always switch off slightly there, because it's just not what I signed up for with them. So Fine Line has that kind of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and it's a bit kind of basic. And then when that opening piano riff comes back in again, and I'm not musically versed enough to know what that chord is called, but he hits a wrong note.
Yeah.
It's a wrong note that creates a sort of dirty note. It's an augmented off note. And that's when I switched on for the entire album. I thought, ah, what the fuck is this note? It's just stunning. And I was very excited to read that during the recording process, it was a wrong note. He accidentally hit it. He meant to hit, I think it was an F, and he hit an augmented F or something like that. And he stopped, and he was going to start again. And Nigel said, no, hang on. What was that? And he said, no, it was the wrong note. And he said, no, that sounded good. Do it again. I'll play it back to you. And I love that was a mistake note that led to effectively the whole tone of the album for me. So it's 30-odd seconds in when you get to that. It's the kind of note I'd expect to hear on like an Elliott Smith album all these minors and odd decisions that aren't sort of common to a regular Paul McCartney song. So it's perfectly placed as track one for that reason for me. Starts off like, not feeling this. And then boom, I'm taking you somewhere else.
Yeah. And as you say, Nigel said, keep that bit. Paul is a big fan of Happy Accidents.
Yeah.
He's still doing
it. That's what I mean. The lyrics, it's like that. The retrospective, go with the flow. But, you need someone clever enough as Nigel to spot that. Would that have been spotted by his previous person? I don't know. Maybe it would have. I mean, that's being mean on any other producer. Nigel's not some sort of god. He's just very, very good at what he does. I really like that song for that reason. It's that piano chord. I always think about that piano chord, and it builds up to the ending where it just keeps flowing through in this loop and builds up and up. It's just such an energetic banger of an opener that isn't really consistent with the rest of the album in terms of high energy, because it's a very morose, low energy, slow tempoed album. So to get that at the beginning, it's sort of like, great, you got me. All right, now let's chill out. I'm spent.
It reminds me very much of Flaming Pie, the song. Same sort of jaunty crotchets going on. And also, one thing we haven't touched on is Paul McCartney is playing throughout the album pretty well all of the instruments.
Yeah.
Like you do.
It's awesome. I mean, but isn't that the other wonderful thing about this album? Everything you're hearing is Paul.
Yes.
To a large extent, there's the orchestras and a few other cameos here and there. But when you listen to that song, it's Paul, the guitar riffs coming in, the backing vocals, the drums. It's everything that you heard about when Ringo left the band and he took over for the White Album, or just you're getting it unapologetically, this is me. But doing it as a full sound. And McCartney 1 and 2, you half get it because it's so underproduced, those albums. Whereas here we're seeing him in his full glory with someone absolutely shoving his face into the shit of awesomeness and saying, fucking, you can be the best. And so great, great opening track, a great, wonderful mistake that led to effectively the whole tone of that song. And lyrically, again, as I said before we started the show, I don't overly listen to lyrics. It's a weird thing. Half of my favorite Beatles songs, there's probably a few lyrics that I just don't remember, but I'll know the melodies inside out. I know every other bit of it. So I don't overanalyze these lyrics. But what I do know is I love singing to this album. It's a beautiful album to sing along to. Every single song just has wonderful chords that, when you're going for it, just feels so nice. And you appreciate where he takes his voice to in these songs, because he can leap up into a falsetto that's so vulnerable when he gets to some falsettos in these songs. And the emotion comes, you can hear the song crying as he's going along, like the instruments are like, Jesus, Paul, what did you go through, man?
I think Ian Lee describes Paul's voice now as old man McCartney. And this, I think, is the first album. I remember when it came out thinking, ooh, his voice sounds somehow different. And this is the more mature-sounding Paul, the first time we've heard him orally growing older. And he's quite happy with it. He's quite content with it. And it's a nice sound, a nice mature McCartney that we've not lyrically and musically, but also the voice gives it that sort of mature authority, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, the cracking tones of his falsettos give it an emotional belt that is so nice. His voice is an interesting thing, because I remember for years before I saw him live, everyone, if you would say, oh, Paul McCartney's playing live, they go, oh, his voice is shot to shit, you know, I wouldn't bother. His voice is awesome live.
Yeah.
I've seen him 4 or 5 times. Each time, it's absolutely cracking. And I just always think that's such a bizarre rumor that goes around about this guy's voice. I think, obviously, when you sometimes hear recordings of a live show, like with anyone, it doesn't sound as great as it was in the audience, because in an open-air field, you know, there's a lot going on. So there may be an argument for that. But yeah, I've only ever seen him live in Old Man Voice stage. I've only ever been, I guess, Memory Almost Full is the one that I sort of first saw him doing, and then onwards. I love his voice. He's so diverse with what he can do vocally. So many different styles. He's pretty one note style though on this album, I would say. He doesn't go into any of his, like, hey, I'm Paul, you know, that sort of crooner kind of thing that he so often does.
How kind of you to think of me when I was out of sorts. It really meant a lot to be in someone else's thoughts, someone else's mind, someone else's kind as you.
Track 2, How Kind of You.
This is a lovely second song, and I love singing this song. It's such a it's a beautiful ballad. I like listening to him talk about this song, because lyrically, how kind of you to think of me when I was out of sorts. This is a song for Heather, as far as I can make out. Every single one of these songs, weirdly, has a kind of sort of break, doesn't it? Like a sort of instrumental jazzy bit halfway through, where it sort of just chills out. And this is, I think, the first one that properly does that. And I know that this is a song that they wrote in the studio, which is quite cool. That this is sort of, he had the idea for the lyric and Nigel said, okay, let's stick with that. And they sort of went around and around until they got it. I'm always fascinated by how Paul writes his songs, because in a way, I always in my head picture that he just sits down and bangs it out. And he's like, well, we'll just call that one How Kind of You. You know, he's done it for so many years. I now have a lot of musician friends who, if they're commissioned to write a song for something, they can kind of just do that. They can kind of sit down and just, they know the techniques of how to make a hit. And if anyone knows how to do that, it's Paul. He's had, what, more hits than anyone else. And this one kind of fits into my thought category of that, of him being in the studio with Nigel and doing a thing. And so it doesn't make me like it any less, but I do think it's almost I just found a good riff and I'm fucking good at what I do. So let's pop that on the album.
Because originally it was a very jaunty guitar strum. So it's, how kind of you, strumming away on the guitar.
Oh,
and
cool.
Nigel Godrich said, no, lose the guitar completely. And then he started on the tape loops. So he got all these. So it's almost like Tomorrow Never Knows territory, a load of tape loops. And literally, Nigel, he recorded them on different channels. So he'd fade up that chord, and then when it was time to change a chord, he'd fade that down and then fade up the other one. So it is, there's a footage of them doing it live. And
Is that the Abbey Road studio sessions?
Yeah.
That is so cool. Yes, and you've got Nigel doing something. He looks like an extra on Star Trek. Fiddling. He doesn't know what he's fiddling with, but we need fiddling going on. The ship's in crisis. Just fiddle.
Yeah.
But he's clearly doing great stuff on it. And it's so, I find it so interesting watching that, actually. I highly recommend everyone listening to this actually watch the full thing. It's him back in the studio. It was in promotion of Chaos and Creation, but I think the BBC had asked him to do something like it anyway, and he'd bent it in to be as part of the promotion. And you get to see him back in the Abbey Road studio. And it's just wonderful, him sort of going, that's where I would have stood. And that I can, you know, if I turn around, there would be John and Ringo, and George is there. And it's really emotional. And he's got the same instruments in there that they used during the Beatles, and similar looping devices. And they play this song, and Nigel's fiddling away. And Paul is staring at him the whole time with this intensity that only made me think of how James Brown used to run his ship, that if anyone missed a note, they were fired on the spot. Yes. Like, he would fire them on stage. And that's the look that Paul's giving Nigel right until the end, and then gives him a big smile. But it's full on.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of you to stick by me during the final bout and listen to the referee as I was counted out. I thought my time was up. I thought I'd never find a someone quite as kind as you.
So yeah, I always thought, I so would love to meet someone who knows, and you might be the person, but might not be able to say out loud on a show like this. I really want to know how intense it got, how much they pushed each other. Had they fallen out at that point and that was a reunion kind of gig, or did they not fall out at all and it was a really creative anger that was driving it?
Well, from what they've said, before they started, Nigel said, my initial reaction was one of terror, not only because it was a very important person, but I really wasn't sure how willing he would be to get his hands dirty. So from the offset, and they've both said that there were heated arguments, and there's one song which we'll come to later where they literally pause shouting, well, I like it, and I do, well, I think it's shit. And I think once they got through, I think that happened at the beginning, but then they got over it. So I think they were pretty okay. It's, you're clearing the air, effectively.
And yes,
Macca was kind of saying, I could have just kept there forever saying, well, I like it. And then at the end you think, well, maybe I'll listen to what Nigel has to say. So I think they got all of that out of the way at the beginning. And I think they got on. Mind you, they've not really done much together since, to be fair.
No, it was definitely a one-off, and he went right back to his old producer and the old songs that he abandoned ship on.
Yeah.
But I mean, that is, you know, you got to wonder, why did Paul work with him at all? Why did he say yes to the idea of getting rid of his live band, who were awesome live? Mm. I mean, what a band he has live. The drummer, particularly, just breathes life into... I mean, the first time I ever heard Band on the Run was through a live version with him on the drums. And when it gets to the guitar riff, which is usually on the album when they recorded it, it's barely any drums there at all, as far as I remember. It's really soft. There's no beat. And suddenly, the kicking beat that he gives it, that's a whole new song. That's a song that suddenly makes sense to me in a way that it kind of didn't on the vinyl. So that's a big call. This is his best friends. He's found his band at last. You know, he's had all these problems with Wings and all of its chaotic reassigning new guitar players and drummers all the time. He suddenly has had the same band that he's had longer now than the Beatles were ever together or Wings were even together. So what made him say yes to this producer who, sure, he'd done Radiohead and Beck, but this was Paul McCartney. He didn't need to say yes to that. I just would so love to know what made him go, okay, I'm going to allow this guy to answer back to me and push me on this one.
Yeah. Well, he did it before. You think when Wings were at the... So back to the Egg, Wings were pretty well on their last legs. And the first thing he did was do McCartney 2. So he went into the studio and did something completely left field that nobody would have been expecting. And it was almost like at the time he was saying he just had enough. He and Linda were just... Wings were hugely successful. They were doing multi-million dollar world tours. They'd reached their absolute pinnacle. And he just lost interest, just wanted to be with his family. So, and it's similar theme here, you know, the live band that he's had, as you say, they are a phenomenal live band. They bring new life into the songs. But it was a similar thing. You know, they've reached their pinnacle. So he's kind of doing the same thing here. Okay, I'll just... He likes to go into himself sometimes, I think, perhaps.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, maybe just to reassert who's boss.
Yeah.
Just a quick... let me pause the album we're working on, because maybe Rusty, the guitarist, or someone else has said something I don't like. Cool, I'll just do my own album. I'll see you guys soon. Yeah, I'm just going to do it with Nigel Godrich. And let's chat after, okay? Let's see how you feel about wanting to lose that riff.
Yeah, because Rusty Anderson, who's a guitarist, here's his thoughts on the album. Nigel had his own agenda. He had it in his mind that McCartney and the band were very close, which we are, and he wanted to break it up because he felt that he couldn't challenge Paul one-on-one if he was supported by the band. I think it was a dopey move, but I do understand. So,
yeah, not happy.
No. Understandably.
Yeah, totally understandably. I think it was halfway through an album with him. But what a move. What a move, Nigel. What an awesome condition to work on the album, just to bring him to every instrument. It's that really is the charm of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it's so great to see that Abbey Road studio session, to watch them play this song. How kind of you. It's two amazing musicians, and you can see the influence that Nigel must have had that on that song. And in fact, there's a riff in it where I remember listening to it thinking, this is Radiohead. And it suddenly made me think, God, what kind of influence does Nigel have on Radiohead songs, composition as well? There's a bit where it goes, and that's I can't remember which Radiohead song that is, but that's a Radiohead riff. It's almost as if he's left his signature in the middle of a song just to say, look how much power I've got over McCartney.
Yeah, it's like his little Hitchcock walk.
Exactly. Yeah, he Hitchcock walked across in a riff. It's so true. But yeah, what a song. I love that song.
Like so many girls, Jenny Wren could sing, but a broken heart took a song away. Like the other girls, Jenny Wren took wing. She could see the world and its foolish ways.
Track 3, Jenny Wren.
Yes. Well, I mean, we're talking McCartney 1, McCartney 2, and this being McCartney 3. This is sort of Blackbird 2.
Yeah.
You've got, what is there? So Mother Nature's Son is a kind of similar tone. I read somewhere, I was reading a great site. This is another great thing about doing this podcast, is I suddenly found all these little pockets of the internet where people are dedicated to analyzing and collecting information about everything of the Beatles and the Paul McCartney Project. If any listener has not seen that website, fantastic breakdown of all their albums. And it was saying on that site, Calico Skies from Flaming Pie, this is a sort of in that territory. And this is part of a trilogy or a whatever of finger picking birds kind of thing. And I love it. And it's a very cool little fact, which is that it's got the Arminian woodwind instrument, the duduk, in it. Yeah. And apparently this is the first song ever in pop music that has it as a part of a song. It's made history, this song, with that one instrument inclusion. It's a really lovely song, this one. It's in the kind of territory along with English Tea, which is later on in the album, where it's kind of almost classic McCartney. It's almost a bit too easy McCartney. Of course he was going to bust out a song that's in this kind of territory. He finds it so easy, but I still love them. I still think they're really Yeah. They're really sweet songs. And I also love that this song, in the interviews that he gave, sort of had him talking about Charles Dickens. And there was a character in Charles Dickens, Our Mutual Friend, which is Jenny Wren, which he hadn't made the connection at the time. Again, years later, he's at a party and someone says, "Oh, Jenny Wren, Our Mutual Friend." Yeah. And he goes, "Oh, yeah, cool, cool. You've retroactively worked out where this song is from." Again, just him busting out lyrics and finding out what they mean at a later date.
There's another Divine Comedy link there as well, because they did a song called Our Mutual Friend. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Nice. Very cool. Yeah, this is the one that got him a Grammy nomination, isn't it, for male pop vocal. So this is, it's a lovely little song. It's not one of my favorites on the album. If I was in a rush to sort of just get to the essence of this album, I think I'd probably skip over this one. But but I still like it. It's not a weak song.
Yeah. I think obviously he's said it specifically was based on Blackbird. Paul and George, when they were kids, used to do their party piece, and it's Bach, Bowie in E minor, which is the same thing, the bass and a couple of strings working up the fretboard, pretty well what Blackbird and this do. So it's a nice little, you know, you think, was he thinking about George? He would have been reminiscing, because George had passed away relatively recently to this album, so maybe, you know, he was thinking about George, and then he thought about writing those songs together, leading him to Blackbird and to this.
That's interesting, because, I've always seen a song further down the line as the George song. I've never thought of it as but obviously that would leap into the whole album, right? Every song he must have been in that mode. A lot of this must have been about George to an extent. But it's a very lovely little song. It's not, as I say, it's not one that I stopped to listen to, but I do love knowing that it made music history by including the duduk.
Yeah.
With Pedro Eustache. Imagine the word mustache and take out the M and put in an E. I read that to write this song, he took a trip to the canyons in LA, and he just sort of sat outdoor in a spot and just wrote this song. And what I was saying earlier about him banging out songs in the studio, it's so nice to read that that's still how he likes to write songs, that there is a process to it that's not just him at a piano. You know, he'll drive and sit out in a nature spot by a canyon, and this song is a product of that. And there's not enough, when you're a Beatles fan, there's so much analysis on how the writing process was for the songs of the canon of the Beatles albums, less so for the later day stuff that they all produced. And it's so nice, the image now in my head every time I hear this song, of Paul sitting out over a canyon with the birds, with the huge skyline in front of him on an acoustic guitar, is that's like, great. I'm so glad that that's still how you do it, that you still love it in that way. It's not just I can do this in a studio, let's just do it for the sake of it. So it's wonderful to read the behind the scenes of all these songs to get that kind of feel that bleeds into your next listen.
Yeah.
And that's what I have now, of Paul sitting in a canyon. At the mercy, at the mercy, at the mercy of a busy road. Who can handle such a heavy load? At the mercy, at the mercy, at the mercy of a busy day. We can think of nothing more to say. Track 4, At the Mercy. I think this is one of my favourite tracks. Yeah.
Really?
At the mercy, at the mercy. Yeah, it's got so many nice phases, this song, as you're listening to it. Again, a wonderful one to sing to. Even if you, like me, don't really know the lyrics. It's, the melody is just so nice. And this is the song, I believe, that when he wrote it, he didn't know what he was writing about. And Heather said, this is about me and about my crash, because it's at the mercy of a busy road. And she said, this is, I've been at the mercy of a busy road. So down in Kensington, where it happened, I guess, is... Where she had her accident, which is at a very busy road. I used to walk there all the time Because Warner Music Entertainment is situated when I work there, just down the road from it. It's a hectically busy road. So yeah, this was interesting in that he kind of says that he used his technique that he sort of used, that he used on Yesterday and stuff like that. You know, he'd wake up and he'd have scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of those songs where he had just that line going over in his head, and he then turned it into At the Mercy. I think I'm right in saying that. But yeah, wonderful song, this one.
It's weird, again, as you were saying about the lyrics, it could be, they're so ambiguous, they could be about anything. I mean, that busy road is obviously, you can align that to Heather. But for me, I think it's, but if it's from Paul's perspective, there's a lot of insecurities on public display, which we've not really heard from Paul before. So things like, sometimes I'd rather run and hide than stay and face the fear inside. And things like, if you take me up, I won't say no. I guess you'd rather see me grow into a better man than the one you know. And it's part, for me, it sounds like his role in the relationship is very subservient, in the same way as his role with Nigel Godrich is. He's relying on her. He's relying on Nigel. Maybe I'm reading too much into this.
No. I think this is what he wants you to do. We should all send... I think we're all meant to send him our homework on his lyrics, and then he can pick the one he likes best. But maybe that's what's nice about it. He's someone who's so built in mythology that everything he does now is an interpretation into what is this about? Who is he? And because it's even rarer for him to put his sort of true emotions into songs, that suddenly is like, this is a big moment that we can try and interpret in many different ways. But from what I've read, I think, as he says, he just didn't know what this one was about. But can that be possible? I don't know. Him just hiding again the reality? Because he's let the truth out there, but then you can deny the truth once it's out there and just go, no, I don't know, I was just dicking about.
Yeah.
Really? Dicking about leads you to those heavy, heavy ass lyrics? All right. Fuck.
Well, he was, again, this is when they first started working with Nigel, so that it had one of their little disagreements, shall we say. And Nigel was saying, the third session, Paul came in with this song, and Nigel was like, whoa, that is so much better, At the Mercy. And Paul said, I think I'm remembering how to do this, which is quite a statement about his songwriting, isn't it? You know, for Paul McCartney to say that.
Must be weird, though, when you're working with someone and the songs they're bringing in are directly about your relationship, about writing these songs.
Yeah.
If that's the case.
Yeah.
You know, are we missing some songs from the album that are, you know, Nigel's a dick and, you know, some way he just didn't have the muse to help him coat it in hidden meaning.
Yeah.
No, it's just, again, it's one of those wonderful things that maybe he was chasing another Lennon figure in Nigel, that he saw someone who could say stuff to him, but he could say it with such authority that it did challenge Paul to kind of meet it. I remember reading, you'll know if this is true or not, but when they did My Love, where the solo comes in, and he'd asked for so many solos off the guitarist that the one they finally get, which he kind of made up on the spot, was done out of pure fury for Paul.
That one.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And you read so much about music being done like that, like Zeppelin, I think it was a take of Dazed and Confused, or one of the biggies, you know, Stairway even.
Yeah.
Where John Bonham was so angry with Jimmy Page that on the final take, when he was like, oh, you want more? You want more? Okay, I'll fucking give you more. And he goes for it. That's the take they use. And, you know, a lot of anger has led to a lot of great music. You wouldn't think that Absolute Fury would channel a stunning solo in My Love, but it did. And maybe there must be an adrenaline that courses through you when you're up against a contemporary who is able to push the buttons without pushing them by making you think that they're not worthy of pushing the buttons.
Yeah.
And maybe Nigel was finally the person, but maybe that was so exhausting that Paul couldn't repeat the process.
Mm.
Or actually, I'd remembered my old theory that I have now, which is I think Nigel got too much credit for it when it came out, and Paul didn't like that.
Mm.
And that's why they haven't worked together again, because he was thinking, this is a Paul McCartney album. It's not a Nigel Godrich album. Stop bringing up Nigel when you talk about it.
Yeah.
And he wanted to show that he didn't need Nigel in the same way that he might have been showing to the band that he didn't need the band. I know that was my theory. I know that's not a fact. Just want to clarify that.
Well, that happened before with the Beatles, didn't it, after Pepper? Because I think the Beatles read a music review. Somebody called it George Martin's best album. And like, so come the White Album. It was, you just stay over there, George.
Catch you later, mate.
Yeah, it's happened before.
Okay, yeah. I seem to think that was my solid theory, so I'm going to stick with it now.
I think so. I think that works.
Yeah. Because when I met him, I said to him, man, Chaos and Creation was amazing. And he said, yeah, you know, I've released another album since then. And I went, yeah. And he really kind of brushed it off for some reason. Like I distinctly remember him not wanting to engage in a chat about that.
Wow.
To be fair, though, he only really wanted to talk about the history of his windmill, which...
Oh, can you tell us any more?
I so wish I could remember anything that was said that day. There were so many things that I really wish I had a photo of the day of him.
Yeah.
When I was waiting outside his windmill with Jeff when he arrived, and he got out and he had a camera with him. And we arrived on a day, actually, where Jeff said to me, by the way, this is Jeff Dunbar.
Oh, sorry.
Who is the illustrator who was doing the illustrations for...
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm jumping all over the shop in this podcast, perfect. With just so many perfect. Memories. I'm very sorry. But Jeff said, I didn't think this was going to go on today. And you'll obviously know why. The reason being that on the front pages of the newspaper that day were Heather Mills' accusations against Paul about his being abusive and stuff like that. So he was like, I think he's not going to be in a good place today because that's pretty heavy stuff. And people in the past have said Paul's a moody dick and all that sort of stuff to me. And so I thought, okay, this is going to be so interesting. I really don't want my hero worship to be crushed here at this meeting.
Yeah.
And Paul came out and he had a camera on him. And he said to me and Jeff, whoop, don't move. And he took a photo of us and he said, photo of the day. And then he put his camera down as if it was like, okay, I'm just taking one shot today. And he was the loveliest guy. I had 2 hours or 3 hours of just sitting next to him in the studio, chatting away while the recordings were happening. There was a moment where an assistant came in and said, Mr. McCartney, lunch is ready. And Paul went, do you know what? We're having such a good sort of, the session is going so well with James inside doing the music. I'll just have it here. So I thought, okay, here we go. He's going to wheel in this like... giant buffet with all sorts of lids coming off. And he comes in with melted cheese on toast, just on a plate. Yeah, that was it. Sat it down next to Paul, and Paul took a bite, and he sort of looked at me as he took a bite and went, sorry, do you want some? And I was like, no, you go. Yeah, like the dude was ready to share melted cheese toasties with everyone.
Oh, awesome.
He was incredibly sweet, and he was talking about the windmill a lot. But yeah, I don't have a photo of him, but he's got a photo of me, which is annoying. super lovely guy.
Which
really
cool. May have been the reason he didn't want to talk about Chaos, perhaps, if that was on the front page of the newspaper.
Good call, yeah.
It was primarily about Heather. Maybe he genuinely didn't want to talk about it.
That's true, yeah. He had, I think, a couple of nights before or the night before, been given the Brit Award for artist of the something, hero of the, I can't remember what it was, a huge celebration for him. So we were seeing him a couple of days after that happened as well. So I thought he'd be totally exhausted, but no, super nice guy. So happy he was nice. God, that would have sucked.
Oh, that would have been so bad.
Yeah. And just remember him brushing it away. And it seems to be an album that he doesn't really talk about too much or play. There's a lot of... most of the songs he hasn't really played live since about 2008, really. And I don't know why. The cracking songs for live, particularly Fine Line, is just such a good rocking song.
I've been waiting on the other side for your friends to leave so I don't have to hide. I prefer they didn't know. So I've been waiting on the other side for your friends to go. I've been sliding down a slippy slope. I've been climbing up a slowly burning rope. But the flame is getting low. I've been waiting on the other side for your friends to go.
Track 5, Friends to Go.
Friends to Go is what I thought before you mentioned it earlier of Jenny Wren sort of having a George Harrison connection was the George song. So it turns out there's a few, I guess. This one really is him. He says in interviews that he almost thought he was embodying George as he wrote it. He felt like he was being George Harrison as he wrote this song with all these George chords. Because I remember when it came out and this was the thing, that this was the George song. Before I heard the song, I heard it was part of the press, you know, that he addresses George in a song on the album.
Yeah.
And it's not the song that I wanted to be about George. I wanted Here Today that he wrote for Lennon. I wanted something that really was a truly... I wanted him to mention George in the song. I wanted him to talk about the old days in a much more intimate way. And interestingly, a much better tribute song to George Harrison appears on the album Ringo Rama, in which Ringo writes a fantastic...
You need to come back and do this album.
I so would love to do Ringo Rama. I said to you that I wanted to do Chaos, I woke up in the middle of the night going, no, why did I not? What am I doing? And also, by the way, I'm so looking forward to the time of your podcast's life when it is just wall-to-wall Ringo albums.
Oh, yes.
Which it will be. It's going to be 19 albums. I mean, he's got like 10 live albums, I think.
I sent a list of, which I sent to you, of albums that are still available for the podcast.
Yes.
And somebody was pointing out to me the, when you see them in a list, Ringo's album titles are quite the thing.
So really?
Just picking some out randomly, you've got Ringo, Ringo's Rotogravure, Ringo the Fourth, Ringo Rama, Ringo 2012, and then he ends it with What's My Name from 2019.
What a joy. He's wonderful. I find it... I must come back and talk about Ringo Rama, because I can't work out who's bought it, who's listening to it. Who are those songs aimed at?
You and me. That's it. At Ringo.
That's it. Yeah, it's just... I don't know. When I listen to it, I'm like, who is putting this on going, oh, better than he's ever been? Oh, mate. Yes, Ringo. Yes. He wrote this song for George on Ringo Rama, which was Never Without You. And in it, there was just wonderful lyrics. The chorus goes, and your song will play on without you, and this world won't forget about you. Every part of you was in your song. Now we will carry on, never without you. And then, never without you, within you without you, within you without you. Here come... Here comes the sun is about you. What? What is that lyric?
Ringo.
No, it's possibly saying that Here Comes the Song is about you. I think that's a Google mistranslation here. It's definitely Here Comes the Sun is about you. Yeah. Terrible lyrics, but like George riffs all the way through, totally from the heart. Just absolutely saying this is about no one else. And that's what I wanted kind of from Paul with this song. When we do Ringo-rama, it needs to be a four-parter. We need deep analysis on every single song.
I can't believe you've heard that. That is so cool.
Man, I honestly walked the streets of Kosovo for 2 months listening on and off to that album.
Yeah.
So what's very nice is, again, in the process of reading up on it for the sake of this, is that the song is actually him believing that he was helped by George Harrison's spirit to write the song. And this particularly makes it a better song for me now, because I'm writing a book at the moment, which is got nothing to do with the Beatles, but the Beatles have found their way into it because there's so many weird little funny theories about the Beatles and just strange things that have happened to them. And this chimes with the fact that he said the spirit of George Harrison helped him. I read a thing years ago in the back of Hunter Davies's biography of the Beatles, which I love so much. And I know that it was an official book, and John's Aunt Mimi had it redacted, and well, not redacted, but it completely cleaned up to take out any controversy. But the later editions where Hunter Davies has added an introduction which lasts about 60 or 70 pages, which is so nice. I love all these Beatles biographies where they do the sort of later reissue, and the Coleman one as well. It's like 100 pages of a foreword before you get to the book. And at the back of this Beatles book by Hunter, right at the end, he goes through a sort of where are they now of every single person. And there's a great thing of Cynthia Lennon about how she had her restaurant, which was the Beatles-themed restaurant in Soho, I think it was, where you could have Rubber Soul and, you know, all sorts of wonderful shitty puns. And then it gets to a paragraph about Pete Shotton, who played the washboard in The Quarrymen and was his best mate for years, Lennon's best mate, and was his assistant for years as well with Yoko, I think. And he, at that point, was living on an island somewhere, like, let's say, Jersey or somewhere like that. I think that's right. Mm. And through an American medium who he'd had chats with, she put him back into contact with John Lennon via his spirit. And they'd written a catalogue of songs together. And so somewhere out there, there were co-written spirit songs from John Lennon with Pete Shotton. I know. Just mad and wonderful. And I love that this song is kind of what that is as well. It's George claiming that the spirits it's Paul claiming the spirits of George are there. And it's made me realize that Paul's a way more spiritual guy than I realized. So when he says that, I actually believe that that might be the case. Like, he says that he had a dream where he was talking to his mum and she said the phrase "let it be," and that's where he got "let it be" from. And but he said that where I know he said that in other places, but he said that in an interview with James Corden in that carpool karaoke where they went back to Liverpool, which I think, and this is coming from a Beatles fan, it's my favorite bit of TV of the last 10 years. I just, it was so wonderful to see Paul go back to all these places. James Corden suddenly cries after they sing "Let It Be" in the car together, and he says, "My grandfather would have loved to have been here for this." And Paul, looking dead ahead, says, "He is." And he says it, not like I'm being comforting. He's like, "He's in the back, mate. I can see him." You know, and so I wonder, you know, when he says he channeled a spirit, the old me would have said, well, is he just using that as a sort of nice metaphor, like he felt like it? Or does he really believe that that George was in the room?
Well, you mentioned earlier memory almost full with the end of the end. You know, that's pretty well openly saying, you know, there is something else.
Is it? What's the bit in that? Again, I'm so bad with lyrics.
Get the lyrics sorted on. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, Paul sings, "At the end of the end, it's the start of a journey to a much better place, and a much better place would have to be special. No Reason to Cry. So he's, you know, he believes it. He believes it.
He does. Yeah. I mean, that's cool to know. Do you remember that story? This is another thing that's going in my book that I'm writing where the Beatles have sort of seeped into. that during the studio sessions of Sgt. Pepper's, I think they were about to record Fixing a Hole. Paul gets a knock on the door, and it's a man claiming to be Jesus.
Yeah.
And he invites him in because he can't be sure that he's not.
Yeah. I think that says a bit more about what they were, you know, ingesting, perhaps.
Yeah. if he believes it at all, is he expecting... And, you know, the guy who turned down the Beatles because rock bands were out or guitar bands were out,
yeah.
You know, rejecting the Beatles is one thing. Turning away Jesus is another from that lesson. And so apparently he brought this guy to the session of Fixing a Hole. And he just sat in the back while Jesus is there in the... He must be on the, you know, Mark Lewisohn's one day going to find the log notes of who was present for the recording. And Jesus will be there. Very exciting. I have a newfound love for this song because it wasn't the George song that I wanted it to be, but now I realize he was just trying to channel George. And it's a lovely song. I don't like it when the Beatles kind of channel each other and parody each other a bit. Turns it a bit mechanical in a way, which... So this song's always sat a bit odd for me, but now that I know there's a weird... spiritual side coming through in it, I just find it more fascinating. It's kind of like when you're looking at a piece of art. If you're like someone like me, art is enhanced by the stories behind the making of the art, whereas a lot of my friends who are properly into art, well, they don't want to know anything. They just want to look at a piece and what it does to them. Art doesn't do that for me. It doesn't mean anything to me. If I look at a Van Gogh painting, it means something to me because I know where he was in his life when he painted that, the pain he was going through, the story, it all feeds into this little artwork, and this song now has that. It was missing that for me, and so now I can listen to it going, cool, he thinks George is literally with him. That's very exciting.
Sorry about that. I was just grabbing another beer. Wow.
Good move.
We're on... Hang on. We've done 5 tracks of 13. It's 1 hour 20.
Yeah,
are you okay?
Sure.
You're not...
Totally fine. Yeah. If you hang on, I might grab a beer. Because I'm now thrown into that...
That quandary.
Okay.
Cheers. What have you got?
It's a Longman Brewery. That's bitter.
Oh, lovely. Very nice.
Yeah, very nice.
Would you care to sit with me for a cup of English tea? Very twee, very me, any sunny morning. What a pleasure it would be, chatting so delightfully. Nanny bakes fairy cakes every Sunday morning. Miles and miles of English garden stretching past the willow tree. Lines of hollyhocks and roses listen most attentively.
And we move on to track 6, English Tea.
English Tea, very similar to the territory of Jenny Wren that I was saying earlier. It's a kind of quintessential McCartney twee. In fact, twee is a lyric, I think, in the song itself. It's like he's sort of properly acknowledging it. And it's a nice little ditty. It's almost like Her Majesty at the end of Abbey Road.
Yeah.
It's just that. It's got that little da-da-da-da-da. So, would you like to sit with me? You know, Her Majesty's a really nice girl. It's a very British song. It's more British than I think of Paul. I don't think of him as a sort of tea-drinking Brit. I don't know, the Liverpudlian thing, I guess, as a as a non, I'm technically British. I have a passport, but I don't feel British in any way. So I have an outsider's view of it, and I don't associate Liverpudlian accents and culture with you know high tea. So I don't fully buy into his kind of drinking tea, but yeah, it's nice. It's a good song, and again, it's got a Dickens reference in it, which is at word peradventure. Peradventure, we will play. And he wrote that not knowing what the word meant. I think he got told after the song. I'm probably wrong about this. I have a feeling he got told after the song was released that it was a real word. Like he said, like he had to run to a dictionary, go, "Oh, please be a real word because I've recorded it. I don't know if that's an actual word." Yeah. And it's and it is.
Which means it's perchance or perhaps or maybe.
Yes. Yeah.
So, exactly. But there's another Dickens reference. So maybe he. The previous Dickens reference, maybe he was thinking, I better check some Dickens. Maybe he came across that word and thought, I'll use that in this song. Don't know.
Yeah, it could be. Could very well be. It's a nice song. It's another song that I could skip over, definitely, if I was listening to it.
When you said about him singing very twee, that's followed by the line, very me. And it's nice to hear him acknowledge, it's an unusual display of awareness or of his public persona. You know, people accuse him of that. I am.
Yeah, he is. Do you know, I'm backtracking on what I said. I think actually he is a tea-drinking dude, isn't he? He is kind of...
yeah.
He is sort of... Even the early Beatles pictures, there would be always him with
Have you seen that site on Twitter, Teetlemania?
No.
You need to follow it. It's one of the finest things. It's basically photos of the Beatles drinking tea. And it started off, here's John drinking tea. And it's been going on for a few years now. And then they delve deeper and deeper. And then, who's that in the back? And then you kind of learn more about the Beatles. And they did. They were obsessed with drinking tea. Absolutely.
That's so cool.
Throughout their entire career. And John holds it very daintily. He's got quite a dainty touch. This is when it gets a bit bad, you know, when you get a bit too obsessed with the Beatles. But, follow it. At Teetlemania.
Teetlemania. I'm definitely getting onto it. That is so cool. Of course he's a tea drinker. What am I talking about? Sweet song.
It reminds me very much of the Ruttles' Double Back Alley. I don't know if you know that song.
Yeah, I love that song.
And it's almost like Paul doing a cover of a Ruttles song, which is irony of ironies.
That's so funny. That's so great. God, that was a good episode you did with Neil. Innes.
Oh man, yeah.
What an episode!
He was so.
And I love that he arrived at Abbey Road early, and they weren't expecting him, and he left, and then he had to come back.
Do you know what? We were walking along, as we were approaching Abbey Road, and there was a cab, and there was a guy getting into the cab, and I looked, and I thought that looks like a ukulele case, and I couldn't. But we were in such a rush, we sort of, you know, I caught him out the corner of my eye. Clearly that was him. And when he eventually came back, it was just, we were so wanted him to get that ukulele. And the guy, Tom, because basically the reason he had it with him, because they were on tour at the time, and he didn't like leaving it in the van because people sit on it or get it, it'd get squashed. And it was a beautiful ukulele. And the guy, Tom, said, he was from Abbey Road Studios, he was saying, "Well, we'll set up a mic just in case, just to kind of encourage him." And it was like the elephant in the room, this tiny little ukulele with a halo around it. And I kept trying to get the conversation to, anyway, ukuleles, Neil. And eventually, but when he got it out, it was just, generally moving. Yeah, lovely.
Yeah, so good. The ukulele, to me, it's the most baffling period of all these musicians' lives where they all gravitate towards the ukulele.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just they somehow find their way there. And I've seen Paul live enough times. Sorry, I've seen Paul doing live shows enough that I get to the moment where I'm like, fuck, he's going to go play something on the ukulele. Imagine not looking forward to hearing something played. But he would play, literally playing George Harrison's Something on stage. Usually just after he's played Here Today by John Lennon. Now, he has to play George Harrison something because he didn't take the time to write a fucking good song about his mate. Instead, we got this spirit-created
very harsh.
I do love it, but it's I do kind of wish that when I was seeing him live that that's the moment when we get the George song next to Here Today, because Here Today is my favorite Paul McCartney song. I just absolutely the first time I heard it, which was again it was in Kosovo, I had back in the US on CD. It's the moment in the lyric where he says I love you, and I remember breaking down because I don't know why. I'm not as emotional as I make it out. I don't just have these earth shattering, like I said, when I saw Imagine when he dies at the end. But I do remember there was something about the McCartney crack in his voice when he says I love you.
But as for me, I still remember how it was before. I am holding back the tears no more. Oh, no, no. I love you.
For me, it's got everything in that song. It's got every... It's the most honest song. Because he, you know, he talks about the fact that did they really even get each other? You know, what about the night we cried when there wasn't any reason left to keep it all inside? You know, we didn't fully understand each other, but you were always there with a smile, all that sort of stuff.
That's the line that gets me.
Is it? Oh, yeah. God.
Because in every song Paul does, there's always that hint of positivity. Every time, however sad it can.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're always there with a smile. And it's just after all this heart-wrenching stuff, the last thing you think of is them smiling together. Oh,
yeah.
Cinematic for me. That's
so fun. Good. Have you seen his Hall of Fame speech where he brings John into the Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
Again, you know, done as a letter to John. And you get suddenly these just wonderful... It's at times like that where I just think, this guy's an incredible writer. He's a stunning storyteller, and you rarely see the storytelling as good about his. I mean, he is a storyteller, obviously. That's what his lyrics are. But I never fully feel that his stories are the bit that separates him from everyone else in the game. I feel the music is what does that.
Yeah.
Like my son's two, and I bought him Hey Grandude, which is Paul's
brilliant.
Latest kids book. And you know, it's really fun, and my son really loves it. Like, you know, he'll go hey grand dude, you know, he'll cry when we're going to bed, like okay we can read Hey Grand Dude. But it's not written amazingly, you know. I only bought it because it's Paul McCartney, and I buy everything Beatles. I don't think storytelling-wise he's ever made me emotionally go, I need to latch onto every single word. But Here Today is a song, and his speech at the Hall of Fame, where I think, wow, you can spin words stunningly. Mm. This is... You've totally been able to reduce the most iconic of relationships creatively, perfectly. You've distilled it. You found your method of telling us about your story, and it's in a letter to John, and Here Today is a letter to John as well, really. That's really a biggie emotionally. How did we get onto that?
That was from English tea somehow,
right? I think we were talking about Dickens.
Okay, and on that note, thanks so much, Dan. We'll come back for part two next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hey!